I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. Today, we talk about the dangers of collaboration. So, as always, George, thank you for your work, and thanks for being on the program.
I'm glad to be here, Derek. Thanks for having me.
So, what do you mean by collaboration, and what do you mean by dangers of collaboration?
Okay, well, it has become a very common practice throughout the West. I don't know if this is happening in other areas, but certainly in the West, for groups to get together to work out resource conflicts on public lands. And this includes primarily BLM and Forest Service lands, not so much National Park Service or Fish and Wildlife Service. And the idea behind it is you get together with a bunch of people in a room and meet often for years to discuss management issues on that particular landscape. And sometimes it'll be a single national forest, sometimes it's a larger area. For example, in Montana, there's a collaborative called the Southwest Crown of the Continent that takes in several national forests, the Flathead National Forest and the Lolo National Forest, and portions of the Helena National Forest. So it wraps around a larger area. And others like that I'm familiar with is the Deschutes Collaborative, which focuses on the Deschutes National Forest alone in Oregon. These collaboratives then get together and try to come up with agreements about management on the public lands, which they then forward or give to the managing agency, for example, the Deschutes National Forest, if it was the Deschutes Collaborative, and ask that they implement the recommendations. And the problem with collaboratives, and there are quite a few that I'll articulate here, hopefully, the part of the problem with the collaboratives is that they are, for one thing, they subvert public participation in general. You have a small group of people who are self-assigned, so to speak, to speak for everyone else and come up with these recommendations. And one of the problems with the design of collaboratives, they're sort of an institutional problem, is that, as I mentioned, they meet often for years and frequently several times a month. And that becomes impossible for most citizens to participate. In other words, generally, collaboratives like to promote the idea that they're open to participation by anybody, but realistically, very few people can participate over the time period that's required unless they are paid to be there. And the people who are paid to be there are often people who have a vested financial interest in the outcome. So, for example, on the Deschutes National Forest Collaborative, it's heavily weighed towards things like representatives from timber companies, foresters who work for various county, state, and national agencies. And I say they have a vested interest because they usually are discussing logging on the national forest. And if you're a forester, your job requires that they be logging. And then there will often be other participants that are sympathetic to, for example, logging, like county commissioners and the like. And then what happens is the representation by what I would call conservation interests is usually limited to a few individuals, and mostly that tends to be people who are, I would characterize in two ways. One, they tend to work for the larger environmental groups, which I use the word environmental loosely, for example, like the Nature Conservancy, that are sympathetic to, timber interests and so forth. And the other part is even when they do represent groups that might be less sympathetic to the timber agenda in general, they still, the people that wind up participating are people who are sympathetic to the collaborative process, which means that it becomes more important to them that they reach an agreement than what the agreement actually means or does for land on the ground. And what I've seen happen a lot of times is that if you read or see interviews with people who are involved in collaboratives, they make a big deal about, oh, well, I could sit down with the owner of this timber company and have a beer, as if that's the most important thing that happens in a collaborative, rather than, you know, I stood up for protecting, you know, wilderness, or I stood up for protecting grizzly bears or something like that. That is not seen as the primary goal or purpose of the participants in the collaboratives. The other problem with the institutional process of collaboratives is that they start out with certain assumptions, which basically, in order to participate, you have to agree with. So, for example, the Deschutes Collaborative in Oregon has started out with the assumption that our national forests are sick and need to be fixed, and the way to fix them is to log them. Well, if you want to challenge that starting assumption, you know, let's step back and challenge it and say, well, are the forests really sick? And how are you defining that? You won't get anywhere with a collaborative because they've already established that as their starting point. So that's another problem with the collaboratives. And by the way, I've been briefly involved in collaboratives that deal with livestock grazing on public lands, and it's the same thing there too. For example, it will be, you know, it's not a question of whether these lands should be grazed and what are the impacts of livestock. It doesn't make sense to graze these lands. If you already start with the assumption they will be grazed, and maybe they get around to talking about, well, how are we going to graze it and maybe reduce some of the impacts. That would might be the starting point. But in a lot of cases, one should be asking, should they be grazed at all? And that is not a question that's, you know, permitted to be discussed or raised. So what happens then, you get groups involved in this, particularly the environmental community. And after a while, I mean, if you've spent 2 or 3 years of your life going to collaborative meetings, you certainly don't want to say that what the end result is was a waste of time. So it's what I call the collaborative trap. You wind up endorsing things that are probably not in the best interest of the public and not in the best interest of the wildlife and wildlands that are on these public lands. So the collaboration becomes a greenwashing in a way, because the average public, you know, reading about, say, the Deschutes Collaborative or the Gallatin Forest Partnership in the papers, believes that the environmental groups are, first of all, representing their interests, and they're grossly outnumbered, even if they were representing the interests of the citizens. But beyond that, the average person figures that, well, it must be a good thing that they came up with these decisions because they worked it out between all these different groups. So I'll give you an example of one. As I just mentioned, the Gallatin Forest Partnership is a group of individuals who got together to discuss what would happen to the Gallatin Range, which is the last unprotected roadless area in the northern greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and one could argue perhaps one of the last most important wildlands that's left unprotected in the lower 48 states. And the Gallatin Range runs from Bozeman, Montana, south to Yellowstone Park and into Yellowstone Park. And this Gallatin Collaborative met for a number of years and came out recently with its own recommendations for dividing up the Gallatin Range into various users. And it often comes down to this sort of, we're going to divide up the landscape among, you know, where places could be logged, where places might be used by ATVs and snowmobiles, where mountain bikes might be allowed, etc. So, for example, using the Gallatin Range, the roadless area in that's still intact is about 230,000 acres. And as I mentioned before, some of this is very important wildlife habitat. In particular, the lower elevation areas are critical for things like grizzly bears, elk migration, potentially bison restoration, wolverine movements, etc. And yet, most of the lower elevations of the Gallatin Range were recommended for some other management status other than wilderness by the Gallatin Forest Collaborative. And that is particularly destructive because we've learned over the years that we mostly have ice and rocks recommended for wilderness. And we're doing the same thing again. And yet the most important lower elevation terrain, specifically one area called the Buffalo Horn Porcupine Drainages, is some of the best unprotected wildlife habitat in the entire northern Greater Yellowstone. And it was allotted primarily to mountain biking use. Another area called the West Pine area, West Pine Drainage, also important lower elevation wildlife habitat, also allotted to mountain biking. And that's because the Gallatin Forest Collaborative Partnership had representation by five mountain biking groups. And then the other participants included the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, the Wilderness Society, and the Montana Wilderness Association. And if you didn't know better, you would have presumed that those groups would have been advocating for wilderness for the entire 230,000 acres. But in fact, because they're part of this collaborative, they felt like, in fact, they even say so in some of their opinion pieces, that all these different users have a right to that landscape. Instead of saying, well, what is the best use of this landscape? And the best use of that landscape is protecting wildlands and wildlife habitat and wildlife use, not necessarily protecting recreational users. And that's the problem that I see in these collaboratives, and that's a good example.
So one minor point before I tell a story or two, and the minor point is, so when you say collaboration, you're using a very specific definition. You're not talking about, Deep Green Resistance working with Buffalo Field Campaign, or various environmental organizations working together to, like there were a bunch of different organizations who worked together to help shut down logging on a lot of the five North Idaho, Eastern Washington, Western Montana national forests back in the 90s. And these were environmental organizations collaborating with each other. And I just want to make clear to the listeners that that's not really what you're talking about. It's sort of a cross-pollination among environmental groups, but instead this other process that ends up being greenwashing.
Exactly. And as I tried to point out, a lot of these collaboratives are dominated by vested people that have a vested financial interest in the outcome. And I think right away that should set up, cautionary signals to people. To my mind, it's almost unethical that a timber company can participate in any kind of decision-making regarding what happens to forests on public land, or that ranchers should be allowed to participate in any decision-making that dictates what happens to, rangelands and public grazing. I hate to use the word public grazing land, but the lands that are grazed by livestock. That's a conflict of interest and certainly seems inappropriate, yet a lot of these collaboratives actually go out of their way to recruit representation from various interest groups, ATVs being another one. And, for example, the mountain biking collaborators in the Skeleton Range Forest Collaboration included a number of mountain bike shop owners, okay? And they have an obvious interest in promoting more mountain biking in the Gallatin Range. And so to me, that just should be a non-stop starter, that these people should not be allowed to participate at all because they have this financial interest in expanding whatever it is they're an advocate for.
So I'm gonna say a few words that perhaps will give you some flashbacks and some nightmares, and I'm sorry for that, which is the Quincy Library. What was it called? The Quincy Library Group? Do you remember that?
Yes, I do remember the Quincy Library Group. Certainly, yeah.
Oh my God, that was part of the problem with this is, just as you said a moment ago, that the Wilderness Society has signed on, so it's obviously great. So the Quincy Library Group, or whatever the actual name was a group in California that met at the Quincy Library, and it was really pushed hard by all the corporate newspapers as all these environmentalists are signing on to this wonderful project. But the thing was just, it absolutely pushed logging, and it ended up being, I mean, the primary purpose of the collaborative process, and I don't think this is an unfair generalization to make, but one of the primary purposes of these collaborative processes is to act as propaganda tools to allow the corporate newspapers or the corporate news outlets or the timber industry themselves to say, look, we dealt with the environmentalists. This all was everybody coming together. Everybody had to give a little bit. And now we have this great, great solution, which unfortunately the ones who end up not represented in this, as you've made very clear, are the Wolverines, are the Fishers, are the trees themselves. It was nothing more nor less than just a big propaganda effort. That one was, at least.
Yes, and what happens often with this, as I alluded to earlier, is that the people who are chosen to represent, quote, the environmental position on these collaborators, I would say often suffer from the Stockholm Syndrome. After they've gone to meetings for, 2 years, they're more interested in being buddies with the other collaborators in the group than in, taking a position that won't be liked by the rest of the group. And it's hard. That is a difficult situation to be put in, to be the odd person out that is always calling on the carpet proposals. The other problem you have, and I've participated in 5 or 6 different collaboratives to one degree or another, sometimes only attending a couple of meetings, sometimes more than that. But if I want to voice my opinion, let's say I'm at a collaborative meeting and there's 25 people there, and you're meeting for 4 hours, at best, I might be able to speak up and make 1 or 2 comments, because everybody, of course, has to have an equal voice in the collaboration, even though maybe out of the 25 people that are there, 24 or 23 of them all agree on the basic premise that I'm trying to call into question. So, you're grossly outnumbered, and this suggests that gives, a fair representation to a diversity of interests is often misleading. Another problem, too, is sometimes there's an unwillingness because of the institutional paradigm that they operate under to listen to other voices. For example, I participated in this Deschutes Collaborative on and off here in Bend, Oregon, and a number of times I wanted to try to get some other fire ecologists. A lot of the discussion happened to do with fire ecology and what to do about wildfires on the forest. Of course, the solution was to do a lot more logging. But I tried to get some other ecologists to come. And the collaborative agreed that they would allow another fire ecologist or two to come, but they would only give them 15 minutes to give a presentation. And this is for somebody who might be coming from Colorado or even other parts of Oregon, basically having to spend a day or two to arrive. And it's almost insulting to say, okay, we're only going to give you 15 minutes to give you a presentation. Meanwhile, local other scientists that support the collaborative's premises you know, can go on for 2 hours or more at a meeting and multiple times, and that's fine. And the only reason they would agree to even let these other people come is so they could give the appearance of having to be open to other ideas. So that's one of the troubling things also about collaboratives, is that when you have this paradigm that most people support, they're not going to be open to other ideas. And, I would say that's sort of natural human nature, so fine, but you have to recognize that that's one of the problems with collaboratives, is they start out with a certain paradigm, an industrial forestry paradigm, and or the industrial livestock grazing paradigm, and they're not really open to discuss anything other than what fits within that paradigm, which usually means more logging or more grazing.
So I have a friend up in Washington State who was, who is a very fierce advocate for wild rivers, for water, and a fierce opponent of the presence of dams and the construction of new dams. And she was, because she's an expert in the area, she was asked to participate in a collaborative process about some new dams that are proposed for the Yakima. And she participated in the collaborative process for a little while and was finding exactly all the things that you're saying, that the whole purpose of this thing was to put out a preset agenda and have people sign on to this agenda that would be to build more dams. And she was never going to sign on to that. And the moment she quit the collaborative was not merely when she realized that her voice, that she was wasting her time, but also when she was asked to sign something that said that if you're a member of this collaborative, once we reach our decision, you cannot speak out against it.
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
So I was going to say, I'm glad you brought that up, because that is often a common denominator in a lot of these collaboratives. You're not allowed to write a letter to the editor or be quoted in the papers or whatever in disagreeing with the collaborative results. So that is, in fact, one of the reasons why I dropped out of one of the collaboratives that I had been participating in. But the other part of it I might add, too, and I sort of alluded to this as well, is almost everybody that goes to these collaboratives are paid to be there. So, you know, they have they don't have a financial interest in challenging the dominant paradigm, because their salaries depend on them participating and doing this. I remember once we were at a Deschutes collaborative meeting, and everyone had to go around and say, why were you there? And the guy next to me worked for timber companies, and said, well, I'm here to advocate for more logging. At least he was honest about what he was there for. But the idea is that most people that are participating are there in one way or another, paid to participate, and that makes it possible. So over time, if somebody like me who isn't paid can't afford to go to all these meetings for years and years and years, so you drop out. So over time, you get a selection that only favors those who are being paid, and usually the ones getting paid are from industry or have, a vested financial issue, that it's from the agencies or they're from the larger environmental groups that have lots of money, like the Nature Conservancy.
Which, by the way, is also one of the things that has always killed me about environmental work. It kills the planet is what it does, which is that, you know, when I was doing timber sale appeals, I was fully aware that all the tech writers and the foresters on the other side were making, this is the 90s, so they're probably making 40-50K a year back then for the mm-hmm. Forest Service. And meanwhile, we were paying for our own damn pizzas when we're doing this on our own time. And so there's this process of really attrition, I think is the word that both you and I are looking for, where you can only give so much time, because you actually have to make a living and pay your rent. And the other people, They're getting their rent covered. It was 50 people on the other side, each one getting paid 40K a year versus seven of us who are, like I said, paying for our own pizza when we're doing this. It's just crazy.
Well, you know, one more way that the institutional bias affects who participates also is that these meetings are almost always happening during the work week. So if you have an alternative job, you can't participate right then and there because you've got your normal work day, and they never, almost never have meetings on weekends or something when you might get a broader representation, even if they weren't paid. Because you wouldn't get these people who are working for industry or working for the Forest Service or whatever to show up, because that would be their days off. So that's another institutional bias that sort of selects for who can participate and who can't.
Well, this also raises, the issue of money raises an issue too, that there's a couple directions to go here. One of them is that my experience of working with grassroots organizations is that there are times and places where they can get some funding that actually allows them to do really good work and enables them to take time off from their job pumping gas or whatever it is they're doing. For those who don't live in Oregon, pumping gas is actually a thing there. But there are also times when money will come to the organization that then is used to blunt an agenda, to channel an agenda away from a more radical perspective and toward a less radical perspective. So do you want to mention that for a second? And then I've got something else to ask you after that.
Yes, I don't have any way to prove this, but what other people tell me is that a number of larger foundations, the Pew Foundation being one. Again, I'm just telling you what other people told me. I haven't verified myself this. But the Pew Foundation is pushing the idea of collaboratives as the way or the mechanism to further conservation agenda. And a lot of these groups that are participating get a significant amount of their annual operating budget from grants from foundations like Pew, who have adopted the idea that collaboration is the way to go. And, of course, that affects the agenda of these groups, not only in the sense that they then have the money to pay somebody to go to the collaboration, but the other effect of collaboration is then these same groups are unwilling to challenge anything that the agency might be doing that otherwise would have in the past been something they would have challenged. For example, timber sales. The Montana Wilderness Association is a good example. I can't remember the last time they ever challenged a timber sale, and I can't believe that they could argue with a straight face that there haven't been timber sales in Montana that impact roadless areas that could be wilderness, because there have been, and they have not objected to that, partly because they're part of the collaborations around the state, and they would upset the other collaborators if they were to start objecting to these timber sales. So it becomes more important to maintain those relationships in the collaboration than speaking out and legally challenging things that otherwise would normally be on the radar screen of these groups to object to. And a further point along those same lines is that a lot of times I'll use the Montana Wilderness Association again as an example, they'll actually support more logging in the sense that I've seen editorials from staff members where they talk about how great it is that we're doing more logging on the national forest and barely mention anything about wilderness, which is supposedly what they're supposed to be advocating for. And one of the problems, again, because you become captured by this Stockholm syndrome in a way, you're either unwilling to criticize agencies and the timber industry because they're your collaborators, or you remain silent and therefore culpable anyway. The issues then people assume, this is again the general public, that okay, if the Montana Wilderness Association is not, I'm using them as an example, is not objecting to this timber sale, it must not be having any negative impacts. And when in fact it very well may have impacts, but because they've been bought off as part of the collaboration, they're not objective. And the other problem, this is, I think, from a strategy point of view, is that the personnel or the people working at these groups, like the Montana Wilderness Association and other groups that are participating in collaboration, the Yellowstone Coalition is another group I mentioned, because they're spending all their time going to collaboration meetings, they're not spending their time going out to the general public advocating, for example, more wilderness. And instead, you're spending all your time trying to convince people at these collaboration meetings who are generally have a financial interest in opposing wilderness that they don't want wilderness, or they're agreeing, you know, they're going to a collaboration meeting and they're saying to the timber industry, they're saying to the ORV crowd, they're saying to the mountain bikers or whoever, okay, tell me what area, let's say the Gallatin Range, you want to utilize for your purposes, and then whatever's left over we'll advocate for as wilderness. And that's instead, if they were, in my view, to spend their time going around to communities saying why the entire Gallatin Range should be protected as wilderness, and going to all the people, even in rural communities, there are a lot of people who aren't, that don't have a financial vested interest in, say, logging or grazing, going to those communities and trying to advocate for and advertise for wildland protection. If the same amount of time was spent by their personnel doing that, we would get more wilderness. I'm convinced of it. We would have more wilderness supporters. Instead, because all their time and energy and money is poured into going to collaboration, the people out in the hinterlands may not even be aware that there are areas being affected by logging or that could be protected as wilderness or in some other way a protected landscape.
Wait, are you saying, God, you're kind of crazy. Are you saying that grassroots activism and grassroots organizing and grassroots communication with actual human beings might be a more strategic way to go than working with industries that have a vested interest in destroying the wildlands? Are you actually suggesting this?
I am suggesting that. And I think it's very important to realize that when you have an important issue where you have to get people out, if you've done that organizing, you can get a lot of people to show up at a public hearing or to write letters to your congressman or whomever is an important person in the discussion that needs to hear from you. But if you're going and spending all your time in a collaboration, as I suggested, people may not even be aware of these issues. And, it's sort of like a friend of mine who was a member of a gay organization. He objected to their strategy. They were spending their time trying to go to evangelical Christians to try to convince them that being gay was okay. And he raised the issue, why are we spending all our time trying to convince people who are almost unilaterally opposed to us that being gay is okay? We should be spending our time with the average public that maybe isn't so opposed to gay rights. And I think the same thing applies to, conservation issues. I think you're wasting your time trying to convince ranchers that they shouldn't be ranching or loggers that they shouldn't be cutting down the forest. You'd be much more successful going to, whether it's the person who's a checkout person at a Safeway or a doctor in some rural town and trying to convince them why wildlands protection is a better thing. And then once you have them there convinced, you have an army of people who can come out and work in public hearings and otherwise to support more wildlands protection. And that's the problem. I mean, I might even say if you had unlimited money, some participation in a collaborative, if you had the right people participating, might be a good thing. But the trouble is none of these groups have unlimited money, and where their money is going is not towards the grassroots organizing for the most part. That gets neglected in favor of these collaboration meetings.
Well, this question of money really raises another important sort of anecdote I want to bring in, which is that there are some groups in the Pacific Northwest who have found their way to who have become aligned with or become friends with people with a lot of money through .com stuff or Silicon Valley type stuff, and they have become very adept at raising money. And one of the things that at least one of these organizations has done is basically send out people who are really good at raising money to insinuate themselves onto the boards of a lot of other groups. And in so doing, these groups themselves have essentially been colonized. No, it's not essentially, have been colonized by this collaborative perspective. So one of the effects of this was that in Oregon, for example, you had at one point a fairly strong grassroots movement calling for zero cut on national forests or on public lands. And that has devolved into this collaborative process of working with industry. And the real radical notion, or the real sensical notion, really, of zero cut on public lands has essentially disappeared through this process of people being more of organizations being colonized by people who are more interested in this collaborative process than they are interested in actually protecting wildlands.
Well, yeah, and you know, I'll make a further point that's along those lines. My experience with most of the petitioners, you know, I'm always generalizing here, so I hope that somebody doesn't fit my generalization and they don't get offended by this, but most of the environmental activists that are participating, being paid to attend these collaborative meetings, in my view, have little experience in natural resource ecology and even conservation history. So when they are presented with, say, the forester at the Deschutes National Forest telling them that we have to log the forest because we're going to reduce large wildfires, even though myself as an ecologist would be able to challenge that, the people that are assigned by conservation groups to participate in sort of a collaborative like that don't have that background. And so they can't effectively, you know, even if they sort of suspect that might not be true, they can't effectively argue in front of the entire group and make sense because they're overwhelmed by the, quote, experts, the foresters or whoever who are working for the timber industry or the agencies. And what I find, too, is that when I have participated in some of these collaborative, particularly field trips, which are fun, I'll articulate some idea that is not within the paradigm. And often there are specialists, and this is another important point that people have to realize. You know, there are a lot of people within these agencies that don't agree with that industrial forestry paradigm, but they're not able to speak up. So when I participate, and, you know, an example would be I was on one field trip where the district ranger was arguing that wildfires would increase sedimentation in the stream and how it was going to be bad for fish. And I pointed out to him that there have been any number of studies that show within a very short period of time, 2 to 4 years usually, sedimentation after a wildfire goes back to pre-fire conditions. However, and the forester was arguing for logging. Logging roads are a chronic source of sedimentation, and that's why salmon and trout populations around the Pacific Northwest have declined in part because they never get a break from the sedimentation because it's constantly happening. Anyway, this district ranger turned to the fishery biologist that happened to be on the field trip and said, "Is that true?" And the fishery biologist, who had up to this point not spoken up, even though he knew better, said, yes, George is right. Yeah, logging roads are a big problem. They're worse than fires for sedimentation and streams usually. And so, you know, you have to realize that these people are out there, but they get overwhelmed by the starting paradigm as well, that they are not able to speak up, even though they may not agree with the general collaborative position on a lot of these issues.
I'm going to try to look something up real fast here, and if I can't find it, perhaps you know the numbers. I just read this, and I'm putting it in a book I'm working on right now. Oh, here it is. One study showed that forest roads produce between 20 and 35 tons of sediment per acre of road surface per year. 1 acre is about 6/10 of a mile of a logging road. So that's about a ton per year every 100 feet. And I want to point out that there are at least 440,000 miles of logging roads in the U.S. on national forest land alone. So I'm just
exactly
pointing out the numbers here. I want to say this again.
Yeah.
A study showed that forest roads produce between 20 and 35 tons of sediment per acre of road surface per year. 1 acre is about 6/10 of a mile of a logging road. So that's about a ton per year for every 100 feet. Anyway, just validate. Just those are numbers to support what you just said.
Right. And, you know, if you throw in log landing sites and other things, too, that are also chronic sources of sedimentation, the numbers would even be bigger. So the point being that, you know, this is the kind of discussion when you're out there with the collaborative and you say, and they're advocating for more logging and building roads and so forth to facilitate that logging. It just never gets discussed very often because it doesn't fit their institutional bias. And so I think that that's one of the things that people have to realize is that there are sort of like a straitjacket on what you can discuss, and even the experts for the agencies are often hamstrung and being able to speak out and raise issues. I'll give you one more example of this. I was on a field trip collaboration on a wildfire issue in Idaho, one of the larger wildfires on rangeland. And the BLM was proposing that they had to do more grazing to reduce wildfires. And, you know, and one of the issues there is that the grazing tramples biocrust, which facilitates the spread of cheatgrass, which facilitates the creation of more wildfires because cheatgrass is highly flammable. And this was an issue, you know, it's well established that cheatgrass, you know, facilitates more fires. And the reason it's called cheatgrass is because cattle generally don't like to chew on it very much, except when it's green for a short time in the spring. So you have the BLM advocate, we're going to do more intensive grazing, which would in effect help to spread cheatgrass, justifying it on the basis that we're going to reduce wildfires. And so that didn't get brought up until I was on this field trip. And then, of course, there were some other people, a BLM botanist, for example, on that field trip, who then echoed what I said and confirmed what I said. But had I not been there, it wouldn't have been brought up by the normal membership of this collaborative.
So we have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and it seems to me that one of the most important things that someone can take from this interview, somebody who, say, especially doesn't live in the West, or somebody who does live in the West too, I guess, is that one of the greatest dangers of these collaborative efforts is exactly what you said about somebody can see, oh, the Wilderness Society supports this, therefore it must be good for wilderness. And it can be this tremendously powerful tool on the part of the those who are actually destroying wildlands.
Yes, and I might add that there's legislation, I'm not up to 100% on this, but legislation that would say that collaborative efforts could get implemented without doing normal NEPA review. I don't want to say 100%, but I think I remember reading that I don't know if it's been how far along it is. But, you know, politicians love collaboratives because it takes away the pressure from them to make difficult decisions. I mean, we are paying senators and congressmen to figure out, you know, what the policy should be. And what they love about collaboratives is it sort of takes away that decision-making from them so they don't have to be involved in a controversy. And they say, well, the collaboratives came out with this, so if they endorse it, it must be good, so we'll implement it as policy. And the Forest Service loves it for the same reason in most cases, unless they're strikingly different from what the Forest Service normally wants to do, which is not often the case. So collaboratives become a way for others who, in theory, are supposed to be considering all these points, like the Forest Service or the BLM, and or congressional representatives, it sort of takes away responsibility from them to have to sort out these competing interests, and it makes it easier for them to move ahead without controversy. And then again, like I said, they the public in general is left out of this, the conversation, because once it's endorsed by the collaborators, it becomes hard to reverse or counter that narrative.
Yeah, exactly. That can be the only narrative we hear. And an example of that from the 90s that I take a very contrary position to a lot of people on, and I still get hate mail to this day about this position, is that when the wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone, which was a very big collaborative process, including Senator Jim McClure, who was one of the most anti-environmental senators ever, at the time, I was talking to a lot of local grassroots organizations out of Montana who were furious about the reintroduction, because they said the wolves are coming here on their own, and because it was a reintroduction that reduced the level of protection that the wolves there, that were already there, had. And so one person said to me, there are timber sales and grazing allotments that are going forward because of the reintroduction. And I'm not saying that wolves shouldn't be in Yellowstone. Of course they should. What I'm saying is that the wolves were moving in, and we never hear, even 20 years later, we never hear that part of the story. And when I say this out loud, I still get hate mail to this day from people saying, no, wolf, you know, that process of reintroducing, that collaborative process, was actually good for everybody. It was, do you see what I'm getting at with this?
Yeah, and you were talking about reintroduction as non-essential population, which reduced their protection under the Endangered Species Act. Those introduced populations in Yellowstone, Central Idaho, had less protection as a result. Whereas the ones that were naturally colonizing up by glacier were considered endangered under the Endangered Species Act and had in theory, greater protection and a legal, you might say, handle that somebody could use to perhaps argue against the logging or whatever, you know, the use that's happening on public land.
And the point here is that that other narrative is completely gone today. And that's one of the dangers of this. I'm just echoing what you said, that that's one of the dangers of this collaborative process, is that we end up coming to believe that that was actually the position taken by environmentalists when it wasn't. So what do you want? What do you want? We have like a minute left. What do you want people to do with this analysis? How can we use this analysis to strengthen wildland protection?
Well, I think that the first thing, take-home message, if you've been listening to everything I'm saying, is to be very suspect of collaboration results and policy recommendations, because I think they're often biased towards vested financial interests. That doesn't mean they're all that way. Again, I'm generalizing, but that would be the first thing to examine who's participating, what their starting assumptions are, etc. And the second thing I would say is that, if there is legislation that's going to certify collaboration as the way to go in the future and on public lands, to fight that, because it very much cuts out the average citizen participation in many ways. And you have to be suspect of the people that are pushing this, people like Secretary of Interior Zinke and others who are obviously friends of industry. So I would say collaboration as a rule is generally going to end up in less protection for our wildlands and wildlife than existing laws and existing legal measures allow us. And it's a way to short circuit those measures that otherwise might be available to people and the general public to protect our lands.
Well, thank you, as always, for your unwavering voice in defense of the wild. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Worthen. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.